truth be told, or your bullshit getting old. The world is getting cold. Don't nobody owe you nothing, so quit fronting. Nothing wrong with being honest. It's a lot of broken promises. Truth be told, we could communicate without all the gun violence. All it took was one conversation. It'll prevent a whole lot of altercation.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to a very exciting episode of Truth Be Told. We got a very special guest for you today. A man who's not afraid to speak his mind. You know him from A&E 60 Days In. Ladies and gentlemen, Matt Reed. Matt, thank you for coming on the show. How are you, brother?
Hey, I'm happy to be here. Seatbelts. Here we go. Bloodletting time.
Well, if you're ready to jump right in, so am I.
Lay it on me, brother.
All right. Okay. One thing I think everybody's been wanting to know is, how did the opportunity come about for you to appear on this show?
Well, like many, the advertisement initially was a bit obfuscated and vague. I wasn't interested in being on a reality show, and I certainly wasn't interested in coming back to a jail or a correctional setting. I'm a former Utah State prison chaplain. I'm an academic. I teach at the college level. I teach religious studies, philosophy. And of late, my emphasis is on logic, critical thinking. And so I'm a professional. And I did my gig, if you will, at the Utah State Prison. I felt like I did the best that I could, and I was ready to move on, because that environment is rough and tumble. But to get to your question, I got an email from a casting director, Chris Catalano. I believe that's his name. He's a buddy, actually. Once upon a time, many of us, and this is kind of insider information that I think the production company, certainly A&E, wasn't interested in getting out there. But this is truth be told, so I'm going to tell the truth.
I love it.
What happened is that each of us back in the day had been either finalists or high up on the Big Brother radar. And I actually went through finals. I think it was Big Brother 5 or something like that. Anyway, I was poised to get on the show, and somebody by the name of Kesar, he was an Iraqi. He ended up bumping me, but I got to know them. And so anyway, that came, and so there's this little email that said, look, we're working on a project. It has to do with corrections, law enforcement, et cetera, so forth. I wrote back and I said, look, I'm not interested in actually being on this. I can give you some advice, some counsel, suggestions. And it kind of took on a life of its own. And I said no a number of times, but Chris, the man, the legend, he's the guy that got me on. And he's one of the main casting producers for Big Brother and CBS generally. And we became very close. I think others, Angele, Alan, I forget who else. It might have been Jacqueline, somebody. But a number of us, anyway, were on that radar, and that's how we ended up on the show. But most of us, I would say, were not interested in reality TV per se. I certainly wasn't at the time interested in being on Big Brother just simply because it was TV. It's because of the money. They paid $500,000. I felt like I could use that. And I can be a character, and I have an advanced lexicon, if you will, comes from years of academic study. I have an academic jargon. Sometimes I'm accused of verbal braggadocio, but you live, you work, you teach in an academic environment, you end up using a vernacular, if you will, that is academically oriented. And so some people will listen to you and they go, I remember when I got back from England and I was teaching at University of Kansas, I was doing understanding the Bible as a TA. And then I taught Western civilization there, and I'd have students say, we love you, Matt, but you can't understand a word you're saying. And one student said, you're deep, Matt, but you're digging in the wrong hole. One thing I got universally though is, you're far too good looking to be an instructor. And that I agreed with every time. So in any event, so it took on a life of its own. And eventually I got on, which led then to them asking a number of us if we wouldn't mind asking family members to see if taking a page out of some of the other reality shows. I think it might even be Big Brother, where you bring a family member or somebody And so I ended up asking Andrew, thinking there's no way in the world, my son, second oldest son, who's doing quite well, actually, he's finishing up a master's and he's going to be doing either PhD work or taking some time off, traveling the world. He loves to travel the third world. I hate that reference because they're not third world people, great people throughout the world. But yeah, and he said, yeah, heck yeah. So my wife and I were very shocked. And I was under the impression the whole time that Andrew and I could be, you know, in the same pod. But come to find out that I was either mistaken or I was misled. But I don't want to accuse anybody. I just want everybody to know I love the production company Lucky 8. Really great people, good people. And I'm not saying that just to self-serve. There was tension. There were times when I found out, for example, the day before that we were going to go into jail, that Andrew was not going to be in the same pod as I. I was angry. I threatened to leave. I threatened to try to convince Andrew to leave with me. Panic ensued. The bigwigs, if you will, pulled out all the stops and convinced me to stay. But at that point, I decided, I can't just pick up and leave. This is a massive network undertaking. It costs a lot of people a lot of time and money, and plus the people involved, every single one of them, all of the producers, I really loved. But I went in with a grudge. I went in kind of hateful, and I ended up, if people could see some of these interviews that would take place behind the scenes, they would pull us out of the pods. I've got to say, I don't want to say I was a bad actor, but I was a thorn in their side because I was always quite willing to stick it to them. I think even at one point I was in a bad mood and I actually threatened one of the underling producers, really actually a good guy. These camera crews that would come in, astonishingly good people, kind people, loving people, just hardworking people, the staff that would come production where they'd come to our home, and then afterwards, where are they now? The camera people, the production assistants. I'm telling you, just top to bottom, side to side, quality people. Lucky 8 is just a wonderful production company. That's it. In retrospect, I feel like, just in general terms, the pressure to make money, stockholders, shareholders, what have you, network pressures, they needed to make money. And so some of the decisions they made in terms of creation of a storyboard and making sure that certain narratives fit that storyboard, I questioned that. Johnny and I, of course, we did some things in Pod 600 that we thought were laudable. For example, Johnny would make crosses and hand them out, and he was indefatigable in that process. He spent so much time, very meticulous, and he made sure everybody got across, even some of the ne'er-do-wells, the gangbangers. In fact, he would focus on them because his hope was to bring a good Christian, if not Christianity, a Christian ethic, and help them. And we did some great, great work. But see, the choices that were made ended up, in our view, being more about the profit that is generated from getting good ratings, because A&E and Lucky 8 got filthy rich. I mean, I'm talking sick rich because our ratings were so good.
Oh, I believe it.
Yeah, well, right now, 60 days in, it's my understanding that on Netflix in the UK, it's their number one show being viewed. And some report that some we participants are kind of rock star-ish there. I'm the only one that actually looks like a rock star, or maybe Matt from season 2. But you know, it's funny, John, he actually met his new wife. The marriage that he was in when he was on season 3 when it aired, great woman. They just ended up seeing things differently and they ended up separating and getting a divorce. But there's Big Brother's big in Germany, and he ended up meeting online this wonderfully beautiful, but even more beautiful inside woman. And so they ended up getting married, and he lives in Germany. Shout out to John, my brother from another mother. So, I don't mean to dominate. I'm interested in hearing your questions and any questions you think that the audience and your listeners might want to hear. I'm interested in combat sports and all those things, but I just want to cap this off.
Hey, this is about you as well. But initially, yeah. Without you having, you know, not having much knowledge of the show, I'd wanted to ask you what kind of strategy, if any, did you have going into it?
Well, the strategy that I had going in was sort of unsettled. I would tell that in my interviews, I would say that what you did to me is creating a sort of trust issue with regard to my son. It destabilized me big time. I went in with this, to answer the question, I went in with a chip on my shoulder, and whatever strategy I had gave way to emotion, because I'm a very rational, or I thought I was. Again, the 60 days in demonstrated to me that I'm not quite the rationalist that I thought I was and purport to be. I've tried to restabilize, but I went in there and I was completely held hostage by my emotions, my anger. Initially, my strategy was to sort of hang low, to watch. And certainly Colonel Adger and Beasley, they were the top jailers there that were handling us. And just two of maybe three in the whole jail that knew we were actually undercover. They suggested as much. And if you watch seasons one and two, you have this wonderful jailer, Noel, who's just probably one of the great human beings. I talked to Ryan from season two, for example, and this Ryan, I'm telling you, I thought I was smart. I thought I was Mensa. I was the baddest boy in town in terms of MMA. Ryan is me times five. He's got this Mensa intellect. He's an MMA skill set kind of guy. Lately, he's into running marathons. And we're in touch with each other all the time. In fact, I just got a text while we're doing this. I said, shut the fetch up. I'm trying to woo the world.
You mean Ryan Secord, right?
Yeah, Ryan Secord. He is just, he's the real deal. Yeah, and I listened to that. And I listened to your podcast with Johnny. I tell you, Ryan is my kind of guy, and John's my kind of guy. Also, shout out to Zach from season one, because he's the original GOAT, greatest of all time. And then you got Nate. What can you say about Nate? He's really good looking. And we, all the women in the world, they've got that little shot with Nate's behind, that white, pasty cottage cheese behind of his is probably a screensaver throughout the world.
It's not like a Ric Flair promo.
Well, but I tell you, Nate is as good a guy as he is good looking. And I want everybody to know that his fellow cellmates report that as good looking as he is in terms of his face and all of that, he's even better looking naked. Can you believe that? I can't even believe that they would say Nate's good looking naked. Who would have thought? Anyway, I completely lost my. Oh, so these jailers would say to us, Colonel Adger, I love Colonel Adger, but again, I have issues that have come up in retrospect, and by that I mean, by going in, you asked earlier about my strategy. My hope was, and the reason I initially said, okay, I'll do this, despite the reticence I felt, the trust issues I felt like with this particular show, because it's so well watched, it has a demographic that is most appealing to advertisers and whatnot. I mean, it's a moneymaker. I thought I could make a difference. And so what I wanted to do was employ some of my academic, what I would call an academic skill set, where you have critical thinking, the ability to observe, analyze, with my experience at the prison, understanding inmates, perhaps a socioeconomic culture. And I mean, by that, I mean, it's not a criticism. Many of those that find themselves in correctional systems tend to come from their lower echelons, those socioeconomically depressed groups and whatnot. And by the way, many, at least at the Utah State Prison, we had, it was known that most of the inmates came from compromised families, non-nuclear families, where you didn't have a traditional mother and father. And I know that I'm getting into non-PC territory when I say, and look, I'm not going to apologize about this for the PC crowd or for the so-called progressives among us. And I say so-called, this term progressive has been hijacked by a quality of intellect that I would say is clearly subordinate to, and this will sound cocky, to mine or anybody who thinks along the lines of a Socrates. You know, Western philosophical tradition is the art of asking questions, and it's usually the question well asked, it's well informed. People aren't interested in questions, they're interested in pushing agenda these days. You go to university and you know what you get? You get activist professors. They don't teach critical thinking anymore. What in the world is going on in universities today when you'll take a class in philosophy, any of the humanities, which is a dying sort of discipline, if you will, or line of inquiry and presentation? What in the world is going on when you can go there and you can come out of a class and instead of understanding more fully what critical thinking is and how to employ it, how to use it in day-to-day life, because that's really what university is. That's Western philosophical tradition right there. And if you just do that, you make a lot of money. But what ends up happening is you get Antifa-like people who come out, who have good intentions, but they're simply not informed appropriately. And the ignorance that is out there. I look at what's happening to, say, Jordan Peterson, for example, and the trolling that he gets and the mocking that he gets. When somebody mocks somebody like a Jordan Peterson, regardless of the content of whatever it is they're critiquing, when they attack him the way that they're attacking, it's like a cult of personality. They're attacking the man, not the ideas. If you want to stick to ideas, look, critical thinking stands on its own. If you're going to attack me, make sure that you're not attacking me as a person, that you're staying with the ideas. And we're in an ideational discussion. So what happens with him is it's less ideational, philosophical than it is a cult of personality. He's a bad person. He's that. People would actually listen to him and think what they'd find is that there's a lot of truth in what he's saying. And he's essentially saying that there's a quality of persecution. There's a quality of ignorance. This business about postmodernism and Marxism, I tell you, it's ignorant. And if anybody wants to have that conversation, I'll have that conversation. But I'll tell all of your listeners, if you got a problem with traditional, conservative, Judeo-Christian values, with capitalist enterprise, with a sort of originalist, constitutional, judicial temperament and approach, I'm just going to say it straight out. Either you're just blindingly ideological, or you might be a little stupid. I doubt it. Most people aren't stupid. They're just not thinking. It's just, look, liberalism is bad religion. That's what I'll say. And the high priests and priestesses, AOC, for example, Ocasio-Cortez, she's a high priestess of ignorance. And anyway, man, I went off, didn't I? And I apologize. But that's what I do, because to be honest with you, I don't care if I left a little early. I left early for a reason. If people look at me and understand me and listen, what they'll find is I am the greatest 60 days in player of all times. I float like a butterfly. I sting like a bee.
Holds all the cards.
Look, I'm clearly too pretty to be on 60 days in. You're too ugly, James. I'm telling you straight. You're too ugly to be on that show. I'm sorry. So go ahead. Ask any other questions. I apologize.
That must be what it is. So you said early on you had anger going into the show. Do you feel like that caused issues in fitting in? And did you feel like you had to tweak your personality at all?
Well, let's put it this way. Maybe the real me came out. I've had anger issues in times past. My dad would sit me down and say, you know, I have longer hair and a beard. He'd say two things to me. Matt, there's a good looking man underneath all that hair, but nobody would know. And then he would say, Matt, I'm sorry. I've had a temper all my life. My dad had a temper, and I'm afraid that genetically speaking, we have vouchsafed to you a genetic disposition to be angry and irritable. And he'd tell me all the time, straighten up and fly right, because I was always arguing. Well, I overcame that to a certain extent. And then when I went in there, I was so angry, anything could tip me off. And I'll be straight up. I always felt like I didn't like bullies. And I told them straight up going in, look, I'm going to be in an environment. I know that it's a tough environment, but if I see bullying because of my, you know, martial arts or rather boxing skill set, and I feel like I'm a man and I feel like I have certain pride, I'm not going to just sit around and watch the bullying take place. And so you ask about the anger. The fact that I went in with a chip on my shoulder, the fact that I had anger issues suddenly, and I was ready to just brawl with production, even threatening some of the guys that were interviewing me, and that was just out of order. And being upset about my son being on the other side. And by the way, that I was only upset for 5 days. This business about, you know, editing into the whole of my experience there, that's just Bush League, baby. I get it. It's a narrative. It's a storyline. It's compelling. But it made me look Bush League. And so people buy into that. It's too bad. Too bad. So sad. Got an issue. Get a tissue. You know, that's kind of so in any event, that anger translated into me being perhaps unduly aggressive with some of the bangers. At one point, Johnny saved me from getting in a massive brawl with Tebow. And I like to think that he saved Tebow. Tebow was not a fighter. One of the things they didn't show was Tebow saying he would not fight me. And I thought that was unfortunate because I get people writing and say, oh yeah, Tebow, he'd kick his butt. Look, he's not a trained fighter. He's a football player. If you're a trained fighter, any fighter out there, MMA, boxing, whatever, you go into any bar and you get all these blowhards that get a little bit, you know, greased up, alcoholed up, you know, a little liquid whiskey. Courage. Yeah, and they want to fight. You know what? Real fighters just don't fight those people. And so I was always battling with myself. Should I punch this guy right in the mouth and catch a new charge or just let it go? But you know what? One of the narratives that was not emphasized, much to my chagrin, because I kept telling the camera crew, tell the producers this, tell the producers that. They wouldn't listen. And one of the issues, and certainly Johnny can confirm this, is that we had some gay inmates, and one in particular, who was so brutalized psychologically, verbally. I'd go sit with him up on the top tier. We weren't allowed to do that. We'd go do it anyway. And by the way, I did find out that if there's a rule to break, I would break it because I was anti-authoritarian. I really wasn't a good model inmate in that sense, separate and distinct from 60 Days In. I'd like to think that I was the kind of guy that would keep rules. But you know what? If there was a rule that said you couldn't do this, you couldn't do that, I tended to break it. But I did it because the rules were so obnoxious and in some cases arbitrary. Anyway, back to the gay issue. They didn't cover that. And they might well have done that because, you know, to be honest with you, what some people call the alphabet group, Dave Chappelle and what have you, but the LGBTQT and I don't know, XYZ and all that stuff, that group of people could well have been served. Politically, emotionally, there's a lot of suicide amongst young people today by getting, you know, a lift up, a hand up from the show in some way or another. And my problem is, look, in the entertainment business, it can't always be about making money. Why don't you try doing some good? And that's why I initially wanted to go on 60 Days In. And I've been, I don't want to say disappointed, because I'd like to say, I think, to be honest, I'd say sorely disappointed in the fact that the narratives that were selected, because you're doing 24/7 raw footage, you can put anything on that you want. I was just sorely disappointed in the fact that so much of it was drama, 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 Matt threatening this. I didn't threaten a lot of people. When I did, that made air. And, you know, you get tired of it. Week after week, when you're actually watching it, when the show's coming on, and you're going, oh my gosh, what are they going to show now? There was a certain excitement that myself and the rest of the participants had, because we thought, okay, this is why I went on. Now something's going to happen. We can do some good in corrections. And then to watch Days of Our Lives or whatever soap opera develop, and you're right at the center, and you go, yeah, I said that. Yeah, I did that. I did that, but 95% of what we did inside was constructive. Although my only regret now is, no, I have so many regrets. I left, I thought, under good circumstances, or rather with a good reason or reasons. In retrospect, I would have done it differently because I just wasn't sleeping. I didn't sleep well for the last full week. Last 48 hours, I didn't sleep a wink. You know, that gets to you after a while. And I just decided, you know, I don't have to put up with Lawrence's farting. I don't have to put up with guys who, you know, ate roadkill 2 weeks before they came in and decided to deliver it in liquid methane in the cell that I'm in 18 hours a day. And I decided I don't have to take the misogynist sort of verbal porn that was ever present 24/7, whether it was in my cell, whether it was out in the pod. You know what guys talk about in there? Sex. You know what they do? They revel in misogyny. They revel in that particular. I know this is probably politically incorrect, and I don't mean anything by it. I'm just reporting. There was so much racism in terms of, you know, the way I was treated by a couple of particular officers, one of the lieutenants. Last name starts with an S and ends with a D. He was protected. Most of us decided in our debriefing that we were going to complain about this cat. Every single one of us complained about that cat. And guess what? Not one bit of it made air. Now, you tell me if he wasn't protected. I'd like to talk to Adger about that, to Beasley about that. I'd like to talk to production about that, to A&E about that. I'd like to talk to them about the fact that they promised one thing in terms of us making a difference and actually end up being on a daytime or evening soap opera instead. It's nonsense. You go over to the female side and, you know, it was pretty decadent over there. I like to call it 60-day sin. or 69 days in. Now, I don't need to get into the details of that, but I will tell you this. The jails were paid good money to take us in. There was a cover-up for a specific lieutenant who was moved, but it didn't make air, which was total, complete, nonsense. I was sold. We were sold a false bill of goods when it comes to debriefing because we spent most of our time talking about that particular issue. None of it came out. It was a waste of time, a waste of our hot air in terms of the debriefing. Minimal coverage of real problems. And I'll tell you straight up, these jails, I can't speak for Clark County as well. Ryan supports what went on in terms of the authority there. And I believe it. Noel's a great guy, and I just think he's the real deal. And I can't really speak for the Arizona thing. I forget the name of the chief jailer with the cowboy hat down in Phoenix. Cool guy. Good people. I can't speak to that. But I will tell you this, that my suspicions are pretty good about those jails. But they already knew everything that we saw, everything we were going to say. And so it was just about getting it out there. And, you know, they had to be devil's advocate for a moment. I get A&E and I get Lucky 8 because they had to show something that was compelling to put eyes on. And they were very successful in that. And so I can't take anything away from them as far as that's concerned. They were doing their job. But what they might have done is opened it up just a little bit, you know. And I think season 6, for example, with all due respect to my friend Richie Weber, who's just a really good guy, and I would recommend that people follow him on Facebook because he's recovered and he's got a great message. But that was a money grab, pure and simple. And it didn't turn out well because the viewership was really down. So in any event, yeah, anger was an issue to circle back. I don't forget, you know. My students sometimes tell me that I, you know, in a lecture that I go off on tangents. I tell them, now look, I'm an educated man. I've been places. I know things. I don't call it in my circles a tangent. I call it an ideational cul-de-sac.
Drop so get it right.
Okay, back to you, brother. I've been just breathing hot air the whole time. You know, if you could come here, it's about you, man. If you could come here and you could put a match right in front of my mouth, it would be a blue dart. That's how much meth it has. So you have any questions? Anything?
After you said dealing with the bullying and the poor portrayals. After it was all said and done, would you say the experience was more of a positive or negative for you, and why?
Well, that's a good question. It depends sometimes on the mood that I'm in. I think taking on the whole coverage of correctional problems is a good thing. I think when people are exposed to some of the very serious problems in corrections, and I would say corruption, there's serious corruption going on in correctional facilities. They're hiring people that shouldn't, be hired. For example, at Fulton County, it was my understanding, and I would talk to some of the bangers, they would point out some of the people, the officers, they have this group that comes in and irritates inmates if they're really causing some trouble. They're big guys, probably fighters, whatever, but they come in very imposing people. But a lot of them were gangbangers. And, at Fulton County Jail, Colonel Adger and others are quick to say, look, we put in this new machine. If you look at where are they now and you look at Nate's portion, he went back to the jail and they showed some very impressive changes, and kudos to them for that. But the fact of the matter is, and this is a very simple truth, it happens in prisons, certainly happened at Utah State Prison, happens at Fulton County to this day, Deontay Wilder, to this day. Look, you know who's bringing in most of the stuff? Officers. So come on. If you're not going to hire the right people, if you're not going to pay them well, these people that work in jails and corrections generally, talk about exploitation by the state and the federal government. Please, let me advocate for them. They're treated poorly. They need to be better paid. And they also need to be better screened or educated and trained. And I'm not suggesting there are real serious character deficits in anybody that goes in corrections, because some of the best friends that I had at the Utah State Prison were some of the officers. But some of my biggest enemies were the officers as well. And I'll tell you, Utah State Prison, some of the people that I despised the most were in administration. Silly little people. We'd come up with, for example, some of these behavioral modification programs, cutting edge stuff that was religious based, stuff for or education and programs for people who had been off paper or paroled, whatever. And guess what? No go. Because the status quo pays too much. The status quo. You go to the Utah State Prison, for example, and I'm sure this applies to Fulton County as well, Jim. So much money involved. You get the state, you get the government pumping in this money. And it's my contention that the programming that takes place, say, at a place like the Utah State Prison. And, I'm not interested in condemning individuals or making a big accusation, but most of the money is wasted. You talk about programming that doesn't work. Programming is supposed to have good outcomes, positive outcomes. The fact of the matter is that the recidivism rate, recidivism is this turnstile that brings inmates back, the recidivism rate nationwide is so high that one could argue successfully, based upon the numbers, that corrections, as at present constituted, is an abject failure. It doesn't just have problems, it is a failure. And when you have officers who are abusing inmates the way I was abused, the way I watched some of my fellow inmates abused, watching, for example, vulnerable inmates getting beat up by gangs with no response at all, and you complain about these things, and you realize that, well, a lot of the officers, they should have been watching the camera, but they were busy eating a sandwich, probably a bologna sandwich, probably the same bologna crap we were eating. Maybe theirs was a little fresher. We'd get bologna that had been, turned black. It was so bad. Just a lot of corruption. It's all corrupt. I know all is an unqualified sort of universal term, and there's always an exception to the rule. I like to think that Colonel Adger is an exception, but I can tell you, I look at outcomes. It's all bullcrap. I don't believe anybody when they say, oh yeah, we're making a difference. 60 days in is making a difference, et cetera, so forth. That is pure unmitigated BS.
Well, I feel it's a shame because I think the show had good intentions at its, you know, conception, but I think it's very much turned into, like you said earlier, into the
drama. Yeah, well, thank you for saying that, because I think the producers at Lucky 8, when they conceived, this is their show. You know, you sell the rights to it and what have you for good money.
Yeah.
They did want to make a difference, and they do want to make a difference. I'm excited to see more of 60 Days In. See what they do, see if the franchise continues. I'm hoping Narcoland didn't kill it. Richie probably saved that whole show. That's how good he was. And Noel was involved with it. That's how good he is. That said, I'm really looking forward to Lucky 8. They produce some really, really good stuff. And I'm not just saying that. Whether I burn bridges or build bridges, I love who I love. And some of the producers there to this day are very, very dear to me. I'd go to the wall for them. My experience at Fulton County notwithstanding.
Now, did you find at the end of it that you had a hard time, you know, getting back into civilian life and regular lifestyle?
Well, it was almost on one level impossible. Apparently, I came back just in time because not having slept, not having hydrated well, and eating the food that ended up being a gut tube plug. It's not just about constipation. It's about a bowel obstruction that threatens you existentially. That's how that goes. and wait till you're in a cell with somebody who passes that existential threat that is that bowel obstruction made of the possum that Lawrence ate 2 weeks before he came in. Wow. That's all I'm going to say. It's just crazy stuff. I will say this, that I almost had to be hospitalized because what happened, I don't mean it would be overly dramatic. Remember when Where Are They Now aired, and I just simply said flippantly in the interview, yeah, I still have nightmares. And I had a troll, and I don't mean to, you know, troll is a harsh term, but we were all trolled incessantly without mercy. Like, you can't believe. Angele, great human being, trolled like you can't believe. Stephanie, while she made some decisions that people have issues with, that's a great human being. And Jacqueline, this business about, you know, her child passing and some of the things that people said, they don't know her.
She's a sweetheart too.
She's a great human being.
Absolutely.
She's someone that I could pattern much of my life on terms of all three of those ladies. Great. The guys that I went through with, especially on the other side, Alan, for example, a great human being. What was my point? I've got off on an ideational cul-de-sac. You know, like a drunk driver, I need a designated driver, and you're it, and you didn't pull me back. I blame you, James.
It was just about adapting back to regular life.
We went out to dinner at a diner, and I'm sitting in the corner. I go in some of my old boxing sessions, I would be sparring as a middleweight. I was a very fast middleweight back in the day. Now I'm a heavyweight, and I'm kind of getting fleshy. I still have the speed of a middleweight and the power of a heavyweight. So watch out. I may be a geezer, but I'll take you out. After some of these sparring sessions with some of these real big heavyweights who were fighting guys like Marvis Frazier, these guys that were world ranked. I mean, we had a stable of fighters, Marv Jensen. We were all world-class fighters. And we'd have sparring sessions that were very much like what would take place in a Philadelphia gym. And if you know much about boxing lore, boxing history, and you look at Joe Frazier, for example, who I knew, very good man, died a hard death of pancreatic cancer. May he rest in peace. I love Joe Frazier. Ali used to say to other fighters, what did he say to Larry Holmes? He told him he was ugly, and then he says, you're no Joe Frazier. He'd always use Joe Frazier as a sort of strength because Joe was that good. But he came out of Philadelphia. In any event, remind me of the question again, because
adapting to regular life when you got back.
I'd like to be able to say I haven't slept, but I'm just kind of getting pre-Alzheimer's. I got sick, really sick, and I couldn't sleep, and I was worried about my son. That's when I started worrying about him again. I felt like I'd just left him. Still to this day, that bugs me that I would leave him there. It does. All of the rationale, the justification, all of that I made when I did leave, I look back and I go, you know, if somebody says something about that on Twitter, I take it because I'm sympathetic to it. Like, how could you pick up and go? You left early and all of that. I did have a good reason, because if I was to beat up somebody and I was about to, then it would have bled over into Andrew's side, because they started to know that there was a connection. And I had a brutal tete-a-tete with a gangbanger through the door. I said, can you go get the tall white guy? I didn't want to name him. He's the guy with the little scar on the back of his head, et cetera, so forth. And he started off on me. He went off on me. And it's some punk, you know, some banger, you know, and in my mind, I'm thinking, man, I'm a professor. I'm a dude that, you know, makes a decent living. I'm a contributor. And I got this gang banger, probably meth, cocaine addicted, you know, yeehaw, who does whatever his gang banging idiot captain tells him to do. And he's telling me what for between this door. I wanted so badly to get through that and just beat him silly. So here I'm thinking to myself in the aftermath of that, man, I got to really watch it. And then when I had that argument with the guy who thought I threw his laundry on the floor, when it, I didn't even know this until after this it aired, but it was Johnny that had put that laundry down, and we were all sitting at the table. This guy accuses me of, now I didn't know who did it, but I do know that I took umbrage at this little guy, half my size, attacking me like that, because you know what? He was thinking, I got Tebow and I got all these people. They got my back. And I knew that, but I got so upset. I went at him. What the show didn't show is that I went at him twice. I circled back. I demanded he tell me what his name was. And I demanded that he stay out of my, you know, my little space. Wherever I'm at, I want him separate. It was going to be a bloodletting, because I didn't want to be talked to like that. But see, that was me after not having a lot of sleep. And so, of course, he went back to Tebow and complained. You know what Tebow said to him? Oh, poor baby, you're going to cry. Because, you know, Tebow was about to get involved. That would have been what was going to happen if I was to sort of instigate something? It would have been just warfare, because I knew Johnny had my back. I knew Bucci had my back. Look, Bucci was tough. People make fun of Bucci. Bucci was a wrestler. There's not a guy in that place, including me, if he got me on the ground, that Bucci could not have taken. I'm just telling you guys that straight up. Bucci was a man's man. He was a fighter. But he was a smaller guy. So people, you know, think, well, remember that crib thing? He gives everybody this introduction. I sat over there. I remember sitting in the corner going, ooh, this is not going to play well, but it's very exciting to watch.
Well, I'm glad to hear that about Bucci, though, because it seemed like people were picking on him, and I feel like he was just trying to do his time and get out.
You know? Yeah, well, you know, they continue to do that. And anybody that says anything bad about Bucci just simply doesn't know what they're talking about. It's ignorance. It's like any trolling. Yeah. People say bad things.
It's
about
uneducated.
Yeah, it is. You're right. It is. But so, you know, I didn't do well after, because it was such a, you could say, it was such a seminal event in my emotional life, this jail thing and all of the things that went on. I went in with a grudge and a chip on my shoulder, and I went out feeling like I just had the crap beat out of me. You can't imagine, I mentioned it earlier, the racism, the homophobia, the bullying, the jail staff that were bangers as well, the lieutenant that kept, you know, we'd have these like cell checks, and guess whose cell check was always checked on a regular basis when it should have been random? It was mine. And this guy, this lieutenant that starts with an S and ends with a D, whose buddies with Adger, who was protected by freaking everyone, he would go to my cell, and he would, of course, these officers, they don't have mercy on anybody's private stuff. Look, when you're in jail, you don't have anything.
Right.
A few things that you do have, little stupid things, books and whatever, little trinkets, maybe a cross that Johnny makes or whatever. You know what they do? They just throw it around, and they throw it on the dirty floor by the toilets, and they just revel in it. I had these little scrunchies for my hair, and this lieutenant guy that starts with an S and ends with a D, and I'd like it to end with a knockout. he took both of those just because. Oh, it's against policy and procedure. I had to take it. Yeah, you know, one day I sat there during count, and I looked at him, and I gave him that look. Like, do you want to fight with me? Because I would be happy to take a charge and beat you silly. I'm not just going to beat you silly. I'm going to put you into a coma and make them take you to the hospital. That's how it got, because it was a one-on-one thing. This bullcrap about no racism, reverse racism, and all that stuff. I can tell you exactly why. I started the very first time, very first day I was there, and I met him. He barked at me and told me, "I didn't tell you could put your bedding there," and he kicked it. This is when we were just about to be processed, and I was separated from Andrew. It's when on the first episode where I told the audience that when I found out that I wasn't going to be housed with my son, oh boy, everything changed, or it changed everything. Well, that's the day that he let me know I'm in charge. And I felt like I knew exactly what it's like. This may not sell well with some, the reference point, because I'm not saying I'm a slave or anything, but I knew what it was like to be in a situation where you had a master and you had to do what you were told. And there was no earthly reason why I had to do some of the things that we were told, just simply because he hated me. And so, you know, at the end of the day, when you're dealing with officers who are lazy, you don't trust them. There's a culture in jail that's so punitive. The food is crappy. We got extra food, extra portions. And I said, well, thank you for the extra portion of gut tube plug. How about just increasing the quality of the cuisine? This is not some like all you can eat buffet of bull crap. You go out to the field, and yeah, there are a lot of cow patties sitting out there. You can luxuriate and eat as many as you want, but how about something edible? You can give me something small, something tasty, instead of feeding me the bull crap you got out of when the cow just relieved himself. Does that seem mean?
It seems like a reasonable suggestion.
And don't get me off going on the pee in the cup business. Oh, just a second. I've got to relieve myself here. If you could see as an audience that there is a cup. Oh, yeah. You know what's weird? Is it starting to smell like bologna again? That's odd. No, I had this piss in a cup, hashtag piss in a cup business. It was hilarious because I, at the end of the day, did it because I was falling asleep. You know, remember the at the end of the series when they did, we all got together with Adger and we did some debriefing. And I mentioned that the real reason, despite the narrative that was given on TV, the real reason I was urinating in a cup was because I hadn't been sleeping and I was getting incoherent and I was missing the toilet and I was wetting my pants. Yes, I'm admitting this on worldwide podcast that I was wetting myself. I did. I'm sorry to have to say. But, you know, you only got a couple of standard issue pants. And so I decided, you know, I'm going to urinate in this cup and then slowly pour it into the toilet and then flush it and all that. And that way I won't get any on the floor because Lawrence is a busybody. He's a germaphobe. And I thought, you know, I'm doing him a favor. But he was lying in wait. He was faking like he was asleep. And he ended up becoming a snitch.
Looking for a reason, huh?
To get and so he came in, and I really liked Lawrence at first. All his braggadocio, he'd always say, "Boy, I tell you, I am such a great gangbanger, all the things that I've done," and he'd tell me about him having a machine gun. How about the cops chased him? And he gave me a scenario one day that was, it sounded very much like O.J. Simpson in the Bronco. And I thought, I've heard this before. I think I've seen this before. You're not O.J. Simpson. He said, no, it happened to me too. And I said, right, Lawrence.
It happened to me too.
Just, if you're going to talk, continue to talk out of your butt and your methane. Stop with the lip moving. Because every time you talk, I know you're lying, brother. So, anyway.
Anyways, all right, for those that saw that awesome promo clip, we know that you've got some pretty good hands, and earlier you spoke a little bit about it. I know you're a former world-class fighter and a pro-level sparring partner.
Yeah.
Can you let us in more about your experience in the field and who you have, like, trained or worked with?
Well, Marv Jensen, of course, he was trainer of the year back in the 60s, and he trained Gene Fulmer. It's old school. So I trained at the highest level, and we would go from place to place competing and then sparring. Amateurs, you fight a lot. You fight in a lot of tournaments. It's a brutal. In fact, that's where you get the brain damage, is these circuits you go on and these tournaments you get in and all the sparring. Instead of turning pro, and I had a number of offers. I was a middleweight at the time, then I grew into a light heavyweight, and then a small heavyweight. See, I'm almost 6'2", 235 now, but back in those days, I was fighting my best years, believe it or not. I was a junior middleweight. I was 156. I was 6'2". So I was like a Mark Breland or a Deontay Wilder, very tall, very thin, but very fast, and I always had a really good punch. But I would fight guys that were, you know, internationally ranked, much less nationally ranked. And I beat a couple of good guys. I tell you, I wasn't the greatest fighter, but I really did try. I did work hard, had good work ethic. And I ended up training down with Roger Mayweather down in the old Golden Gloves gym down in Vegas. I did a little wrestling as well. I was what you might call a prototypical precursor MMA fighter, but I didn't have the kind of ground game that would make me successful in an MMA bout. These MMA fighters today, they're so well-rounded. They know jiu-jitsu. They know boxing, Muay Thai. They know how to kick, karate. A couple of my idols, Muhammad Ali. I do like Fedor Emelianenko. I would spar with heavyweights, prepare them for their professional matches. One of the reasons I didn't turn pro was I was privy very early on, being sort of academically inclined, to this idea that this was not good for the brain. And I think I may have elements of CTE, that is chronic traumatic encephalopathy, but I made myself aware of some of the strategies that fighters, and this is something each fighter out there, whether it's boxing, anybody in combat sports, certainly MMA, be aware of the fact that there is obviously going to be some brain damage when the brain is impacted and traumatized like that. But there are things you can do about it. One of the things you can do about it is circumvent the trauma sites through problem solving. In other words, you grease new neuronal channels. Synapses can still continue to fire appropriately. There's going to be some damage in the brain, but if you'll continue to think hard, problem solve, do academically inclined things, have good hard conversations, confrontational confrontations, or discussions, dialogue. And I don't mean in a mean way, but push yourself intellectually. And what you'll find is that much of the brain damage can be circumvented. I know with me, after sparring sessions as a middleweight, I'd come home, I'd spar with a guy named Young Sanford, Fred Hoop, who was an internationally ranked heavyweight. Fought Larry Holmes, got beat pretty silly, but Fred was one of my dear, dear friends. I sparred with a guy named Tony Pulu, who fought at a very, very high level. With those Polynesians, boy, they come off the boat in their lava lavas and what have you. And I'll tell you, that's a tough group of people. They are now getting really, really good at football, not just like rugby and whatnot. But in any event, so I prepare heavyweights, I got a real insider's view into boxing, the corruption. I found out that this may surprise some people to hear, but I got it from Fred Hoop himself. He's still alive in Chicago, and you can even, any journalist that wants to go talk to him, hit him up. He was known as Young Sanford. He's there, and he has been of late anyway, last I heard, he's training young fighters, but he was very near and dear to me. He told me a story. He may not like me saying this. I don't know if he said it to me in confidence, but I'll assume he didn't. He was a well-ranked heavyweight at the time. Ali was on his tour of beating a bunch of bums, not unlike Joe Lewis and his bum of the month thing. But Ali's people approached him, according to Fred, and offered him a fight if he would go down in the 10th round. Now, at the time, I loved Ali, and I still love Muhammad Ali. I don't believe Ali was in on that. I don't. I do believe, however, that the Nation of Islam was. I don't know about what they're doing these days. I don't know. And I don't want to get involved with them and have a confrontation with them on any level. I'm not interested in that because some of the best work they do is in prisons, and I really like that. But Ali was controlled by the Nation of Islam, by Muslims. And it's not just any Muslim. He became Sunni. He left the nation. And Islam is, I think, a religion of peace generally. But anyway, that really hurt my feelings because I'd always heard that when he beat Sonny Liston in that second fight, that Sonny Liston had taken a dive. And come to find out that Sonny Liston himself was involved with organized crime. So I'm convinced that that was a dive. That was a fake one. But it wasn't Ali's fault. Of course, he changed from Cassius Clay to Ali. That was his handler's fault. But see, this was very reminiscent of a story that Marv Jensen told me. He was also the manager, trainer of a heavyweight contender by the name of Rex Lane. Rex Lane fought Rocky Marciano, and it was a good fight, but he ended up losing by TKO or knockout, I forget. We'd sit and watch films with Marv, some of the old school fights. Floyd Mayweather, and especially, Mike Tyson. Mike Tyson is probably the greatest historian of boxing on the planet. Teddy Atlas is really good too, but there's something about Mike Tyson people don't understand. This is a man who in his own right is brilliant. Now let me sound odd because sometimes his presentation value is a little off and he tends to be a little nutty at times, but I'm telling you straight up, you get to know the mind of Mike Tyson. There's something brilliant about it. And that's coming from an academic. I really have a lot of respect for Mike Tyson. In any event, Marv Jensen told me that he and Rex Lane were staying in the same hotel as Marciano's people. Now, the argument had been for years that Rocky Marciano, and this is probably an argument that came not just from insiders, but from people who were jealous, envious of Rocky because he was short, he was light, but boy, what a punch he had. Best in the business ever. Period. Mike Tyson, Deontay Wilder, notwithstanding, it was Rocky Marciano. Take that to the bank, baby. Anyway, Marv Jensen said to me, you know, Matt, I'm going to tell you a story. And this will tell you everything you need to know about boxing and politics. I want you to write it large. Just remember, though, that there's a way around it if you do this right. Because he was prepping me to be a professional fighter. And I was on that track. And if not for to cap off what I was saying earlier, I didn't go pro because I didn't want the brain damage and all that. In any event, this is what Marv told me. They were staying at the same hotel. They were having breakfast. And the waiter brought both Rex Lane and Marv Jensen a glass of orange juice. They both tasted it, and they both commented on how it tasted just mildly off. They couldn't put their finger on it, but they figured it must have been some kind of a canned juice. It wasn't fresh, despite the quality of the hotel they were staying in. They drank it down. As it turned out, both of them showed symptomology consistent with a drugging that lasted for about 24 hours, and the fight was that night. So Marv Jensen cornered Rex Lane, and Rex Lane fought that fight under a cloud, a drug cloud, and it affected his mind, body sort of control, hand control, and he fought the whole fight in a cloud. Now, Marv wanted me to know, though, he didn't feel like Rocky Marciano, who was an upstanding individual. Rocky Marciano was salt of the earth, great man, and I would never accuse him of this, and neither was Marv, but he was handled by people who were involved with organized crime. Now, I'll tell your listeners this, and if somebody's got an issue, they better have the kind of experience that I have, or they can just shut it because this is what's going on in professional boxing today. There is still an organized crime. It's not one group or another. There is a concerted effort on the part of many when it comes to betting and these kinds of things and controlling fights. If you see, for example, a fight where you think somebody clearly won and you have cards that seem somehow curiously off, what you're really seeing, and this is the truth, I don't mean to go all Teddy Atlas on everybody, and by the way, I love Teddy Atlas, but I'll tell you this, and this is the truth, there is corruption to this day. Now, I don't know about the MMA world. I think Dana White, despite his very raw, sometimes callous way, he's brilliant. This is a man who knows what he's doing. He knows the fight game. And I think he would argue that they're doing what they can. UFC is doing what they can to control that. And I believe that because the ownership team that was with UFC before, they were good, fine, upstanding people. And I think the ownership of UFC today, they're good people, and they try to weed that out. But boxing, I'm telling you, boxing is a dirty sport. It's a dirty industry. And I don't want to accuse certain or specific promoters of malfeasance or corruption. I don't need to get any kind of slander or suit, but I will say this. The next time you see a fight and a card that comes up and Twitter goes nuts, just remember there is corruption. It's not just incompetence. And there's a lot of incompetence out there. There's pure, unmitigated, selfish, greed mongering, money mongering, power mongering, corruption. And that comes from the inside. That's it and that's all. And like I said before, somebody's got an issue with that. My suggestion is go out and get a tissue because you're wrong and you don't know what you're talking about. I hate it when people go on Twitter or wherever and they make a comment and they judge somebody who's on something and they have all this wonderful experience. And yet they say, oh, yeah, but you had this KKK type sort of white nationalist. And by the way, biggest trolls out there, hate to say it, young white males. I don't know what it was. The brothers, they love me because maybe it's because I talk like a brother. And I actually was born a brother. I told one of the first things I got in trouble from my dad with as a teenager, and I still remember it. I mean, really in trouble. I didn't know what a pimp was. I just knew I wanted to be a brother. I wanted to dress like that. I wanted to ride in those cars. I wanted to be like Muhammad Ali. And I said to him, I want to grow up. He said, what do you want to be when you grow up? I said, I want to grow up and I want to be a pimp. And I got in trouble. I didn't know why I was in trouble. Now I look back and I go, oh, man, I said I wanted to be a pimp. Oh, baby. Makes no sense at all. But anyway, I love African-American culture. And I always have. I love that, you know, Motown, baby. It's my thing.
You know, besides being a great fighter, you know, a teacher, an entertainer, you're also a giver in that you're a hospice chaplain. You know, how did that opportunity come up and what made you want to help ill patients and their families cope with death and things of that nature?
Oh, thank you. That's a really good question. I appreciate that. Of course, my advanced academic credentials are in religious studies and theological ethics, and I'm really interested in ethics. I have an interest in medical ethics. I think the reason I'm a hospice chaplain today, and I've been one for some 20 years in addition to being a professor and all of that, but my heart lies literally. It's not in mixed martial arts. It's not in combat sports. It's not even in academics, although I love that. It's in hospice. Hospice, just by definition real quickly, is palliative care or comfort care for those who have a terminal illness. They have been diagnosed and then prognosed with terminal illness and then with 6 months or less to live. And so I'm a part of a hospice team that is comprised of a physician, nurses, nurses' aides, chaplains, social workers, and volunteers where needed, and really good communities that provide support. And what I do is I help people transition to the other side that, you know, help families deal with loss, patients deal with death and dying, and help them transition. One of the reasons, and I think the very big reason that I got involved in this is while at Oxford, I was I built relationships with professors who they called dons there, who were both chaplains and professors. And I thought, you know, that's the way I want to live my life. Because prior to going off to graduate school and finishing up in Oxford, my dad succumbed to pancreatic cancer. And I took 2 years out of my life to take care of him. The doctor said he had 3 months, maybe. But when he was diagnosed, he actually had had pancreatic cancer for a year. And that's a very harsh diagnosis. You don't last very long after the diagnosis. But he ended up living for 2 years. And at that time, he was too young to qualify for the hospice benefit. And so what I did is I quit thinking it would be a 3 month, quit everything I was doing. I was about to get married. I was in school. I was doing my thing. and those 3 months turned into 2 years. And I realized then how much I appreciated, my dad appreciated other people who helped. And so that was my opportunity to give back as a hospice chaplain, because I knew how important the kind of spiritual feedback I was prepared to give would be for families who have loved ones who are facing this, you know, ultimate journey. I don't like the term death anymore. I prefer the term transition. I've experienced things that don't just lead me to believe, that demonstrate there is a very robust life that we move into. There will be those, the so-called anti-theists, Sam Harris, Richard Dawkins, who, and I don't mean to get rude or anything, but I'd be happy to debate them on any level whatsoever, because when they go in, when they conclude that there is no God and that religion is poison, like, who was that? Anyway, a journalist, he's passed away. He had cancer. I'm forgetting his name. Oh, Hitchens. It's just really, it's not just academic malfeasance and incompetence. It's just morally wrong for an academic to come up with a conclusion like there is no God, given the fact that we know so little. It just seems very arrogant. In any event, I've had experiences in hospice that demonstrate to me that not only is there life after death, it's very robust, and that there's family on the other side. And so for those of you out there who are very fearful at times of outing yourself as a Christian or as a Muslim or as a practicing Jew, that you have a robust view of an afterlife, you're on safe ground. There's nothing that a so-called academic, and with Sam Harris, I like to, and any scientist who enters the realm of religious studies and mislabels religion, not even understanding what religion is, and then they start making these propositional truth statements that are just total nonsense. Look, I'm just going to say it. It's stupid. They're ignorant. And if they'd ever like to sit down and get a bloodletting philosophically, a man who actually knows what he's talking about and can wordcraft a syllogistic, deductive argument that will just blow them out of the water anytime, anywhere. But maybe not, because I don't like taking candy away from kids. Anyway, so I got into hospice because I wanted to help people and bring a smile to their faces. Does that answer the question?
Absolutely.
And by the way, James, I'll tell you this. I don't mean to cut you off, because you've spoken all of 30 seconds during this, because I'm such a methane-spewing blowhard. The other day, so we had some friends come by on a Sunday, and they're supposed to be at church. And so I simply said, well, why aren't you at church? They said, well, there's some other meetings later in the day. So we had some time to kill. And as an academic, it's serious business asking a question, because they always have to build a case. They got to say this. They got to do that. Got to refer to this body of evidence and whatever. So my wife chimes in and she says, oh, if you've got time to kill, don't ask Matt a question, because he'll kill it for you. Plus, she told me the other day, with my long hair, she thought she's getting tired of living with someone who's starting to look like Willie Nelson.
So what's wrong with Willie, man?
That's what I said. I said, what if I had his bank account and his voice? She says, that's three strikes, baby. Nothing. Get out of here.
Man, not only do I want to say I think you're one of the most intellectual and humble people, but I've probably learned more today than I have on previous episodes, and I hope that the listeners did as well. If you have any, you know, projects that you're working on currently, or want that the fans to know about, or where they can reach you to talk to you, now is definitely the time to do that.
Well, you know, I went on to, with Richie Weber's Facebook, I went on to his, I guess the equivalent of a podcast. And so I had to go on to it. And so I went on and made my own Matt Reed thing. And it was weird because I got about 300 requests, friend requests from Pakistan. So I went off. I didn't know what to do with that. I don't know why. And so I literally got like 300 requests from Pakistan. I asked one of them, I said, well, why are y'all friending me? And he gave me an emoji that said, thank you, and clapping. So I figured it was some kind of a hack or what have you. Although I love the people from Pakistan. Thank you. But I'm Oxford Sofic on Twitter. That's my professional, professorial Twitter. I'm on, for the show, where I don't really follow anybody. It's Rice Street 607. That was my cell number. And I'm writing a book. I've got a bunch of publications going out there because my name, Matt Reed, is a pseudonym. But you'll never know who I really am. But I've written a book, and it's, I guess, by my standards, it's a very good book. And it details all of my thoughts, experiences, with regard to my prison chaplaincy and my work at Fulton County, my experience with Lucky Eight. And it gets into great detail. It's not published yet, but it will get a publisher and it will do quite well because, to say the least, it's provocative, just like me. I bet you, James, I bet you that I'm the best looking guest you've ever had. I don't want to brag about it. But I've got to be the best looking. No, I'm sorry. I'm doing my Ali shtick again. I'm probably, when you say Matt, you're humble. I say, yes, there's a humble aspect to me. I'd like to see it come out one of these days. Oh, and can I say one last word to all the 60 Days In fans and to fans of your show? I want you all to know, and this comes from the bottom of my heart, and I think I can speak for the rest of the participants. And in every case, I have deep respect for my fellow participants. And there are some that people still like to troll and what have you. I just want to say that I do appreciate, and we do appreciate the fact that you watch the show, and all of you, I know you have a lot of MMA fans. I want to give a shout out to all of your followers who do MMA podcasts. All of your fans, I watched who was retweeting and liking some of your announcements for this particular podcast, and I was impressed with the quality of the people out there, the goodness that is out there, a lot of good people. I want you all to know that I love you, and if I ever have done anything to offend anybody, I apologize. I'm being real, and my stay in 60 Days In, it was real. It wasn't fabricated. And so shout out to all of you cats, all the participants, Ryan, Zach, John, Nate, and my son, Andrew. Andrew, are you around? Oh, he's visiting from college. He was going to give a shout out, but he's 6'4", 285 pounds of pure muscle. Can you even believe that, James?
Both some big boys, man.
Yeah, I love you, brother, and I'm sorry for yapping so much, but I guess that's what a podcast is, right?
Hey, and you know what? It's about you today. And, of course, as always, I'm your host, James C. Turner Jr., and you can, of course, find me on Twitter at JPsAllDay1990 and at James C. Turner Jr. on IG and Facebook. And, Matt, I just want to thank you again for coming on the show, man. I've really enjoyed having you.
You're more than welcome, and you are a good personal friend. I love you, brother. And best of luck with this podcast. And, you know, I love the title. I love the fact that it's truth be told, where you're willing to go places with it. And this truly is, and I meant this in that little clip that I sent you, this really is a winner. And you are a winner. You're a good man, and you've got a great future. And so thank you very much for having me on.
Hey, anytime. You're a friend of the show, and you know you're always welcome back. And much love to you too, man.
Okay, thanks. We'll see you.
All right, everybody. Make sure to tune in, and thank you again.
Let the positive vibes all day. grinding, trying to make a better way. Better listen to what the song say. Truth be told, you better slow your roll. I've been on the same road before. You know I'm the chosen one. I spit flows from the brain, young G1.